Welcome to The Point. I'm Steve Junker in for Mindy Todd. It is a sure sign of spring when baseball season gets underway. With the Red Sox home opener a week from today, we decided it's time to talk baseball. Joining me in the studio is Steve Derderian, staff writer at the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Steve.
Thank you for having me, Steve. You know, I'm usually not up this early, but, you know, I like to listen when I am, so it's good to be here.
And on the phone with us is John Garner, director of broadcasting at the Cape Cod Baseball League. Welcome, John.
Good morning.
John, and Steve, thanks for joining us. And we want to hear from you, Sox fans, and anyone, of course, brave enough to proclaim support for another team. What made last season special? What are you looking forward to this season? Do you have tickets to go up to Fenway and see the Sox? You can join the conversation at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. You can also send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. The Red Sox coming off what many are calling their greatest season ever, capped with a World Series title. And the World Series, of course, as big as it gets, but there were so many other things that made last season special, even before the championship. So I want to ask each of you for a favorite, and I'll start off here. I'll jump in. The Sox got a new manager last year, this young guy, Alex Cora, young manager, 42 years old, first-time manager. And he came in, he's not a cocky guy, and he came in, he's a very grounded-sounding guy, and it was amazing to see how the baseball gods smiled on Alex Cora last year. It seemed like every move he made worked out, and there were moves, and just to throw one out there, first game of the World Series, he pinch hits for Rafael Devers, third baseman. He puts Eduardo Nunez in there, who's not known for like the hot pinch hitter you want to throw in there. And a lot of people, I remember when that move happened and kind of going, what the heck is he thinking? And Eduardo Nunez hits a three-run homer that really caps the game. And you just think, what is Alex Cora, what does he know? Where does this come from? So that was one of the things last year that just made me smile as I watched the season. Steve, what was it that made the season special for you?
Well, first of all, you have to go with the wins, right? 108 wins is just completely unprecedented by anybody's standards. And even more impressive that they really led wire to wire. You know, they did lose their first game of the year, and I think won their first 17 of their first 19 games. I mean, this was a team that was just unbeatable in a sense. I think they only got swept once during the regular season, which we were talking before the show. There's so much cynicism that goes on with the Red Sox that people believe this almost can't be real. It can't be that easy, but it was. And even with the Yankees that won 100 games, again, they led pretty much the whole way and dominated the Yankees really throughout the year.
I think they only lost three games in a row last year, so it really was quite an incredible season. John, were you following the Sox last year, and what was kind of a high point for you?
Well, I think the baseball executive in me loved the transactions that took place, not only before the season, getting a cleanup hitter like J.D. Martinez, who teamed with Betts to make the best 1-2 punch in baseball, but also the trade deadline transactions of getting Steve Pierce and Nathan Eovaldi, and that put them over the top. That was you see a lot of great teams do that. They have very good teams, and they get those nobody knew that those two guys would end up being the two of the heroes of the World Series and down the stretch.
And that was work of general manager there, Dave Dombrowski, and he's the guy making some of those player moves behind the scenes. And all of those moves also seem to fall right into place. Like you say, you get Steve Pierce, who's
former
comes
Cape
in,
Leaguer, by the way, John.
Another former Cape Leaguer, and we're going to talk about how many Cape Leaguers are on the Sox and in the major leagues right now. But really, every one of those personnel moves, they seem to pay off. You know, they even brought in Brandon Phillips, his second baseman, for a little while, and he had his moment of glory in which he won a game for them. This was a veteran who hadn't played in a long time. And then, you know, everybody played their part in a big way last year, I thought.
Right, absolutely. I mean, especially look at that outfield. You know, Andrew Benintendi in left field, young guy, was just a rookie the year before and really kind of gave that anchor in left field. Jackie Bradley Jr., another Cape Leaguers. We'll come to find out quite a few on this Red Sox team. Unbelievable plays in the outfield, clearly saving a lot of runs, a lot of outs that way. And then Mookie Betts, not only an MVP, but a gold glove and a silver slugger that year. I mean, just unbelievable. And then John mentioned J.D. Martinez, 43 home runs, 130 RBIs. Again, these are just numbers that we just haven't seen in many years past. So, and then a guy that kind of got overshadowed, guy who just got a contract extension, Xander Bogaerts last year, actually had 103 RBIs, kind of fell under the radar because you had Betts and Martinez. So just everything, like you said, seemed to fall into place.
John, you're mentioning the players that were brought in mid-season last year, but one of the great things about this team, I think, if you follow the Red Sox, a bunch of these guys come up from the system. They're homegrown guys, and you think about somewhere like Xander Bogaerts, who they just gave an extension to, but this is a kid who came into the system at 16 years old, and the Red Sox have really brought him along. You think about Andrew Benintendi and Mookie Betts. So to see guys come up from the system, that gives you a real sense of ownership as a fan, because you love to see you've been following them along. And also, it just feels good. It feels like the Red Sox family sort of embraces its own players. Does it feel that way to you, John, when you watch it?
Yes, they're everyday players. I still think the Red Sox need to do a better job of developing their own pitchers. They have not done a great job. Most of the pitchers that they've gotten from other teams, like a Chris Sale, someone like that. I think that's the thing they need. But as far as positional players, the Red Sox do a great job of bringing them along, not hurrying them to the major leagues. Bogaerts is a little bit of an outlier because he came up so young. He had played a lot of baseball. I remember him coming in the 2013 World Series as a youngster and actually acquitting himself very well.
What is it about the pitchers, you think, that makes it harder for the Red Sox to develop them? Are they just not scouting them that way? Is the minor league system not developing them that way?
It's a combination of things. I think they get maybe a little impatient. A lot of the guys that they bring, some of the younger pitchers, they'll deal away to get top-line veterans. And if you look at their farm system, they don't have a lot of great young pitchers in their system. Part of it, they trade some of them away. Other ones, they're not patient with them enough, I don't think. So, and maybe the instruction needs to be changed a little bit at that level.
Now, the Red Sox have been able to keep their team together pretty much going into this season. There's a couple of pitchers that are not with them now, Joe Kelly and Craig Kimbrell, but the majority of the team is the same team that won the championship last year. But baseball seems like perhaps the hardest sport, a team sport, to repeat as a champion. You can contend, but to repeat is really difficult. Steve, what do you think? Is that your impression, and why is that?
Yeah, it's certainly fair to say. I mean, the last team that did it, I believe, was the 2000 Yankees. Well, they won it three straight in 98, 99, and 2000. So I just think that, again, not every year things are just going to fall into place like that, and where your pitching's all working up correctly, or everyone's staying healthy, or you sign the right guys. It's just sometimes it's just a matter of time and a matter of luck, and it's just very hard to get all that to fall into place year after year after year. It's not like football. There's so many more games. It's such a longer season, so much harder to play it out over the course of 162 games. And in any pro sport, it's going to be hard to repeat. But when you have that many moving parts, it makes it that much more difficult.
John, any thoughts?
It's very tough. I think chemistry is hard to put your finger on. And I think it was a magical season for Cora. Like you said in the opening, everything he did turned to magic. It really did. And so far, look at the moves. They haven't even – the one big question mark was losing those two back-end relievers. Well, they haven't been able to get to the relievers because their starters are giving up more runs than anybody in baseball right now, 1-4 on the West Coast. So we'll see if that straightens around after the second time through the pitching staff.
Listener,
every year is so different, and it's really tough for a team like the Yankees to repeat, you know, two or three times. You just don't see that anymore.
It's true. Well, like Steve says, there hasn't been a repeat champion since 2000. So here we are 18 years later, and it's seen so many good teams come and go, but it indicates how hard it is to repeat.
Yeah, and the thing is, people were saying to Alex Cora last year, like, this might be bad for you because, you know, you saw 2013, John Farrell's first year as manager. Now, he was a pitching coach of the Red Sox beforehand, but he won it in his first year as manager, and then it kind of seemingly went downhill from there. So I'm sure Cora is trying to avoid that, but it seems unfortunate that seems to be the pattern these guys are falling into. Terry Francona, same thing, 2004.
His first year, he came in, he won
the World Series. Now, he won it again in 2007, but, you know, these guys certainly get off to a great start and then, you know, hasn't been great afterwards. So I think Cora is trying to course correct that history a little bit.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you make a trip up to Boston to see the Red Sox play live? Tell us about your plans to catch a game this season or some of your favorite moments from Fenway in the season's past. You can call 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. or email thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before we went on air, Steve and I were sitting here talking about how the Northeast is really there's a perception that it's a sports dynasty place these days, and it hasn't always been that way. I came to this area in about 2000, and Sox hadn't won a World Series since 1918 at that time. But in the last 18 years or so, it's really between the Red Sox and the Patriots. And it's just this is a place where sports is happening.
Yeah, I mean, what we were saying before, I believe it's 12 championships now, 6 with the Patriots, I think 4 World Series, 1 Stanley Cup, and 1 NBA title. So in a short time, I'm only 25 years old. And in my lifetime, I've seen all the teams win. And I said it even after the Bruins won in 2011, you know, I can't complain anymore. I really can't. I've seen it all. I've seen all 4 teams win and been around many family members who never saw this before. It was just so unprecedented. So we've certainly been lucky.
We had one year like that, the 1985-86 season. I remember that was my last year in New Hampshire. In fact, that was the year I came to the Cape later on that year. And the Celtics won the World Championship. That was the third Bird-McHale-led championship. The Patriots, won 3 straight road games, and as a wild card team, got into the Super Bowl before getting destroyed by the Chicago Bears. That was their first Super Bowl appearance. The Bruins made it, I think, to the Stanley Cup Finals that year, and then the Red Sox got into the World Series and should have won that, ended up losing to the Mets in the Bill Buckner game. So that was an amazing series where all 4 teams made it to the final game.
So that's in 1985?
85, 86, yeah.
And then you have another 15 years until you get turned the corner.
Right, and then the 21st century came on board, and Bill Belichick and Brady came on board, and everything kind of changed after that.
I'm curious to know about some of your favorite players to watch on the team, John, as you have kind of been watching young talent for so much of your time. For the Red Sox right now, who are the ones that you really delight in?
Oh, I love Benintendi. You know, I was at the baseball writers' dinner the last 2 years. I actually walked out with him last year, and I'm about 6'2", and I was about 1.5 feet taller. He's listed at 5'9". I think that's being very, very generous. And a guy with a beautiful swing like that and to be able to generate so much power for a guy that small is amazing to me. Just a great wrist and perfect swing. And I think he's going to be a real star. And, you know, I love the outfield. I like the fact that they're able to be patient with Jackie Bradley Jr. because I think what you've got there is, you know, maybe one of the better center fielders since Ken Griffey Jr. And unfortunately, his pattern has been he's very streaky as a hitter. He'll go like 0 for June, and then he'll be the hottest guy on the team in July. So they've been very patient with him, and I think it's really important for them to have a fourth outfielder, and I guess they're going to be able to play maybe J.D. Martinez a little bit more in the outfield this year to spell him, which I think would be good.
Those are
two of my favorite players for sure, and obviously watched Chris Sale pitch a lot in broadcasted a couple games he did on the Cape in 2009, and he's a real star if he can keep it with his health.
We're talking baseball this hour with John Garner from the Cape Cod Baseball League, Steve Derderian of the Cape Cod Times. You can join the conversation at 866-999-4626 or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker, talking baseball this hour with Steve Derderian, staff writer at the Cape Cod Times, and John Garner, director of broadcasting at the Cape Cod Baseball League. And we're going to shift gears now to focus on the Cape Cod Baseball League. Attending a Cape League game is a summer tradition for many people. We'd love to hear from you. Why do you enjoy Cape Cod baseball games? Have you hosted a player from the league? You can give us a call, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Attending a Cape Cod baseball league game is an opportunity to see some great baseball. And as you say, John, to see some of the future stars of the major leagues. Give us a sense of just how many players have gone on to play in the majors right now.
We've identified over 1,300 players over the years, including both Babe Ruth's roommate, Jumpin' Joe Dugan, who played for Barnstable in 1919, and then Pi Trainer, who was a Hall of Fame player and broadcaster and manager with the Pittsburgh Pirates. He played shortstop for Falmouth and Oak Bluffs. He played for 2 different teams in the Cape League in 1919. We were able to go back and get every single box score that he played in during that season in 1919. So it's and go from there. Right now, there's like 303 players in the major leagues as of 2018. The year before that was a high watermark, 306 players, current players in the major leagues in 2017 at the end of the year. So very exciting time. The numbers just keep increasing every single year. The World Series had 14 players, including most of the heroes of the World Series. Steve Pierce, who was the MVP of the World Series with all the home runs. He played for Kootenai back in 2004. And then also you had Jackie Bradley Jr., as Steve had mentioned, played for Hyannis in 2009, and he was the most valuable player of the ALCS. So we had some great talent and people doing very well from here.
And you were mentioning Chris Sale as well, and just you could sort of tick off the names there. Joe Kelly, these big players who were big.
Both played for the YD Red Sox.
For the YD Red Sox, right. Before we went on air, Steve was telling me when the Cape League started. I didn't realize it went all the way back to the 1800s. So the first organized baseball game, Steve, you were saying professional game, was
1869. With the Cincinnati Red Stockings.
And then the Cape League starts when, John?
Well, actually, it might have even started before that. I think the union, we have it as 1885, but then it says ninth annual Barnstable versus Sandwich game. So that takes you back to, like 1876. The Union soldiers brought it back from the Civil War and made it part of their July 4th celebration. And there was a big parade every year. And the Civil War soldiers would all dress up, and there'd always be a baseball game between neighboring towns. And so I think it dates back to like 1866, 1867. The Cape Cod kids, soldiers, learned the game from their New York brethren in between the battles of the Civil War. And that's what brought it back. And then those games became more organized in a league. And then the league really reorganized in 1923, and they had six different teams. And that kind of brought you up to the future. They've been playing ever since.
And when did it become a college league?
It actually kind of went back and forth. You had a lot of college players even before World War II. But in 1963, it actually became sanctioned by the NCAA. So other than those players like Peter Ford, who were grandfathered in that were already part of the league, you had to have college eligibility remaining in order to play. So that was 1963. So that was a watershed year for the Cape League.
Let's talk.
Before that, it was a town team. All town teams were all over the country. If you see some of the old movies that took place, like the one with the Iowa cornfield. That's what the Cape League was. It was a bunch of town teams. You might have had a grandfather and a father and a son all on the same team. And that all changed after 1963. And then it was all college players, mostly from the East Coast, I would say, maybe Midwest. And then in the mid-80s, that changed again when we went back to wood bats. After a 10-year hiatus, they used aluminum. When the Cape League became the first summer league team to go to wood bats, that changed everything as well. And then in 1988, they had 42 major leaguers that played in the Cape League in that one year alone.
John, one thing I've always wondered about is how the teams select the players. Are they recruited? Are they invited? Does the league sort of assign them? How does this break up?
Yep. Each field manager and general manager is responsible for recruiting their own players. Mm. Most of the teams are put together in the early fall of the year before. And then they just fill in the blanks, with kids that get hurt. They have to get replacements or players that are selected for Team USA. Sometimes they'll opt for that instead. But for the most part, the rosters are pretty much set as of, like, let's say, October 15th of the year before.
The trajectory.
And each general manager will have a special relationship with a head coach. And about 75% of our players come from the top 30 NCAA Division I baseball programs in the country. Teams like Vanderbilt and Oklahoma and, Alabama and Florida State, that sort of thing.
One of the fun things about going out to a Cape League game is when they announce the batters coming up to bat, they say where they come from, and they come from all across the country. And you think about these young guys coming here to the Cape for the summer and what it must mean for them if you come from somewhere like Alabama, or you come from somewhere like small town in Texas or in the Midwest. It's really must be an enormous experience for these young people and a cultural experience, as well as getting to just play ball for the summer.
Yeah, it's absolutely a different atmosphere, especially when you're living at a host family's house. You certainly have to be appreciative, kind of live under, you know, their rules and stuff like that. But look, they're there to play baseball. These are guys who have aspirations of playing professional baseball. And in a lot of ways, this is their first kind of go at things, being in an unfamiliar place and having to perform at your, you know, peak level. And what I actually kind of like, too, is you get a lot of these guys who become real close playing in the college season. They spend, you know, 8, 9, 10 months together. And then for 2 months, sometimes you'll see college teams actually playing against each other. One might be pitching against their own guy. So it is interesting in that dynamic that it's kind of broken up like that for a couple months. And a lot of the guys you asked, they said, no, I didn't even know about Cape Cod until I heard about the league, or never even been here until I crossed the bridge. And you definitely get a lot of cross-cultural things. But I think for the most part, anyone's just honored to be invited to this league.
You know, for people who don't know, the trajectory of a baseball player is entirely different from a lot of other professional sports. You can leave college and go right into playing Major League basketball or football, but baseball doesn't happen that way. There's much more of a long sort of growing period and learning period. John, can you talk a little bit about that and what that trajectory is for a young person?
Well, that is true in some cases. In other cases, like let's take Andrew Miller, who's probably, I would say he and Chris Sale, looking at them, and Anthony Renato, those are the three best pitchers I've seen in terms of knowing that kid is going to be in the major leagues in a couple of years. Well, it only took Andrew Miller 11 months to get in. He was pitching in a playoff game in Chatham in 2005, and by July 31st, 2006, he was starting at Yankee Stadium for the Detroit Tigers. That's about the fastest I've ever seen. Less than a calendar year, he goes from a Cape League mound into the major leagues. And he never left. I mean, that's what type of talent Andrew Miller had. He's just a tremendous pitcher. And then you have other people that will toil for 6, 7 years and finally, you know, get their call up. I think the college, coming from the Cape League, playing college Division I baseball, playing in the Cape League, you get a faster rise than you would if you're coming directly out of high school. That's a real long process. That could take, you know, 4, 5, 6 years, whereas a college player, particularly playing at this level and doing well, is going to have a much faster trajectory of getting to the major leagues.
And I think what's really special about the league, too, when you just look at its format, you know, you have 10 teams. I mean, they're all nonprofit. They play a 44-game season, and it's free admission. Now, of course, they do take donations. You know, these teams are appreciative of the help they can get. But it really is one of the greatest values in baseball, seeing future major leaguers play for free in front of, you know, on some nights, thousands of people. And, you know, the concessions from just about every ballpark are great. They're run by, and the league wouldn't survive without all the volunteers that help out with it as well. Just really, really good people, good personalities. And, you know, the cliche, it's kind of like a Norman Rockwell painting, but in some ways it's throwback baseball. You have a lot of these teams that don't play with lights. Their games start during the week at 5 p.m., and on the weekends they'll play some matinee games. So, you know, if it's too dark, it's the old school way. These games just end in a tie if it's tied. And it's just, it's a real throwback to what baseball used to be before, you know, you had national television and, you know, different mm-hmm. primetime kind of setups like that. So
there's no really replay either. You
right.
watch the games and it's right there in front mm-hmm. of you. You have to be paying attention.
Exactly.
I go to these games with my son, who's 9, frequently. And one of the great things for us watching the games is you see how these plays that are in the majors are routine. You see a sharply hit ball to the shortstop and they just sort of gobble it up and throw it to first base when you're watching the Red Sox or any Major League Baseball team. But you see how these plays that look so routine are not routine, because unfolding right in front of you with young guys who are still putting it all together, all the mechanics, and they have so much talent to begin with, and still they're putting it together. And it goes wrong, you know, with more frequency than it does in the major leagues. But it gives you a real appreciation for the skill that it takes to play this game in even the most basic fielding positions and the most basic plays.
Right. I mean, there's no perfect, at least since I last saw Kevin Youkilis play first base, there's no perfect infielder. I mean, with yeah. different hops and whatnot, and getting used to the different kind of bounces, different fields is going to take, it's certainly not easy. But again, these guys are competing to showcase in front of scouts. So they're trying to put their best foot forward and impress and possibly raise up their draft stock.
And John, the scouts are here through the summer watching these guys.
Yeah, the crescendo, the high water point would be around the All-Star game. We've had as many, I think, in Harwich, and when they played probably 10 years ago, there were 130 credentialed Major League scouts at the game. Between scouts, and we had a couple of general managers. And so routinely, you'll see, you know, anywhere from 7 to 15 to 20 scouts at any one given game. And then it kind of grows as the summer goes along. And then there's a mass exodus. You would think that most of the people would be here during the playoffs because that's probably the best baseball and most competitive. And but after the All-Star game, a lot of them leave because they come for that week or that 2 weeks prior. And then you all of a sudden you look and see, where are the Major League scouts? You just don't see as many at that point.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, in the beginning of the year. And at the end of the year, you get a lot of, I don't want to say replacement players, but you get temporary players that have a temporary contract to play with these teams. And some of them are local guys. I think, John, we had Joe Sullivan a couple of years ago. Kid from the Cape was able to play this past year. We had a pitcher for Katuit who was, you know, actually grew up kind of in that neighborhood. And, it's nice to see those hometown guys still being a part of the league, especially as we talked about with those roots of their being former Cape Cod natives completely, you know, filling up this league. And, you know, it's so different now with the culture across the country of baseball in places like Texas and Florida and California, where you can play year round and you have kids who have really risen to that highest level. And you just don't see that as much here as you do in other parts of the country. So it's real nice when you get to see a hometown.
It's been a real challenge, Steve, for the Cape League because the calendar is being squeezed every year. The College World Series and the Super Regionals are being played later and later. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the schools like the SEC. They have to be back on their college campus by the 20th of August. So you're getting, and they want to get home a few days earlier to pack and say goodbye to their parents. And after that, after not seeing them the whole summer, that's why you have an exodus of players, particularly those teams like Wareham and Chatham last year, which made it to the finals. The championship game wasn't until, I think, the 14th of August. So that's what happened. And they were, and all the games last year were sweeps. All the playoff series were sweeps. The only thing, the only fly in the ointment was Hyannis got rained out one day, and they couldn't play that next day. So all the other playoffs had to wait. I don't remember that for one more day. So other than that, it went as fast as it possibly could.
Hey, John, the Cape Cod Baseball League, each team has such strong ties to the community. Tell us about the various ways that the teams and the players are interacting with the community in addition to playing the games.
Well, I'd say the number one thing, all 10 teams have a youth sports clinic all during the summer. You know, you can sign up for 1 week, 2 weeks, and typically they're morning clinics, so you'll come at 8:30 and you'll stay till 12. In fact, my grandnephews both came down from Maine and went to the Hyannis Harbor Hawks camp last year, and they had a great time, learned a lot of baseball, had a lot of fun, and they're being coached by the coaches and the players, and that's probably the number one thing, and that's a real tie-in to the community because probably 85% of the people that are in these clinics, these kids, are, you know, natives of Cape Cod, and the other 15 to 20% are maybe vacationers that come down and take their vacation around these baseball clinics. And so that's a huge deal. There's other things like, different teams like a Katuit or a Hyannis or a YD would get involved with their local bank, and then they have an autograph signing session at the bank to promote business. We've done things at the Cape Cod Mall in the past with things like that. So it's kind of a neat thing. And these are year-round organizations where all 10 teams plus the Cape League, they meet on a regular basis, at least a monthly basis year round, to make sure this happens. They just don't open up the ballparks in June and welcome people in. It's a year round process for these teams. Each has their own budget, and so it's quite a big deal.
I want to back up to something you said earlier, John, about it being a wooden bat league, and to talk a little bit about what it means for these young guys to come here. Most of these guys in college, I'm assuming, they're all playing with aluminum bats.
Yeah, NCAA uses
aluminum. They do. They either play with aluminum bats or composite bats, which are a little bit more like the wood bats, but they're not wood bats. And now players are a little bit more used to it because they may play their non-traditional season in the fall. A lot of them do use the wood. A lot of them practice with the wood. But they play with aluminum bats, and that changes the whole concept of the game because the sweet spot is so much larger on an aluminum bat than it is a wood bat. You have to, with a wood bat, you have to hit it almost perfectly to be able to get, you know, good wood on the baseball. Also, the ball carries probably 10 to 15 feet farther with an aluminum bat than it does with a wood bat. I remember Jeffrey Ledbetter, who set the NCAA college home run record back in the 1980s, and he just couldn't make it because all of his fly balls, instead of going out, were caught, you know, 10 to 15 feet in front of the fence when you get to the major leagues. So it was a big, big difference. Other people are able to make the transition very easily. Others would have a really hard time. That's why you see typically in the Cape League, the power numbers and the batting average numbers are down during the first couple weeks in June, and then they kind of pick up as the summer goes on in the Cape.
Is there a big?
You can hit 300 in the Cape. You're probably going to do well no matter where you go.
Tell me, is there a big cost factor for the teams using wooden bats as opposed to aluminum?
Yes, the individual bat doesn't cost as much, but you go through. You might go through two or three aluminum bats during the whole summer. You might go through 20. Each person go through 15 to 20 wood bats during the summer. So It's a huge difference.
We are talking baseball here on The Point. If you are following along and want to join us, give us a call. It's 866-999-4626, 866-999-4626. With us, John Garner from the Cape Cod Baseball League and Steve Dedarian of the Cape Cod Times. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Talking baseball this hour with Steve Dedarian, staff writer at the Cape Cod Times, and John Garner, director of broadcasting at the Cape Cod Baseball League. The baseball season is long. Sometimes individual baseball games can seem even longer. There's a lot of discussion about whether this is turning off a younger generation of potential fans. We'd love to hear from you. Are your children or grandchildren as interested in baseball as you were at their age? How can the game be made more appealing to the next generation? Or is it something that you shouldn't mess with? Give us a call at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. John, I want to start off with you, ask you directly, do you feel like there's any danger of baseball declining in popularity?
Oh, I think it's already happened, particularly with the younger, I hate to say it, but with a lot of the younger people, because the attention span maybe isn't quite what it was. And I think baseball has not changed like some of the other sports, like football. Even though football is probably the number one sport, they seem to make changes almost on a yearly basis to try to make the game safer. It's pretty much in that three-hour time. There is no time clock in baseball, so you have to find other ways to make the game quicker. And, you know, whether it's, you know, less time in between pitches or I think it's a lot of it revolves around the sponsorships and the advertising in Major League Baseball. You'll take a typical Cape League game is about 2 hours and 20 minutes, 2 hours and 15 minutes long. Add an hour to a Major League game. In Major Leagues are now, you know, anywhere from 3 hours to 3.5 hours long for a typical game. I went to a game 2 years ago, Yankees-Red Sox game at Fenway, Chris Sale versus Tanaka, and it was 2 hours and 15 minutes long, 2-1 game. That's because both pitchers work at a frenetic pace as opposed to a regular, you know, pitching matchup that would take place. So it can work, but you have to have cooperation from both sides. So I think Major League Baseball needs to put something in place to make the game a little quicker. That's my opinion.
There are a lot of suggestions now about how to start tweaking the game to move things along quicker, for instance. Steve, tell us about some of the things they're considering.
So changes they've already made this year, I believe commercial breaks cannot be more than 2 minutes long. So that kind of cuts in the time, you know, getting the pitchers out there, warming up and getting back to the action. I believe they cut down pitchers' mound visits. It's been really a seamless transition. I think it started at 6. It moved down to 5 now. So you get 5 mound visits per game. So that's kind of sped things up. I think in the future you will see, and this is my prediction, that you will see a pitch clock. You're already seeing it in the minor league levels, where these younger players, as we talked about, are already playing with it at a professional level. And at a certain point, these are going to be your future major leaguers, and they're just going to be used to it by then. And a pitch clock, for those of you who don't know, there'll be a clock kind of in the outfield and then one for the pitcher as well. And a pitcher has to deliver a pitch before that clock winds down, or else it's a registered ball given to them. So,
and it might be, say, 20 seconds?
It varies, but I think, yeah, usually between 20 and 30 seconds. So just to, you know, so the pitcher's not constantly, you know, twiddling around, tossing up the rosin bag and trying to stall and slow down the pace of the game. And they've done that with the batters, too. They don't really let the batter step out of the box anymore. I think the rules are going to have 1 foot in, unless, you know, there's a timeout in the action, of course, or, you know, foul ball, something along those lines. There's always going to be breaks in baseball, and as long as baseball is 9 innings, there's only so much you can do. It's going down a little bit. I believe the average was 3 hours and 5 minutes in 2017, went down to 3 hours last year. So, I mean, the 5 minutes isn't going to make all the difference in the world, but it is sort of trending in the right direction, I think. And, you know, long term, like I said, I think you will see a pitch clock, because that's been the biggest thing floated in terms of people who want to speed up the game.
John, do any of these changes filter down to the Cape League?
I don't think you need. First of all, I think the Cape League is much faster run, and you know, there is a rule that I think it's the 2 minute rule is already in there, so you have to get out there and start. And they usually beat that by, you know, 20 seconds. So it's not usually, the umpires do a great job of moving these games along. You don't have the timeouts. Not that many of our games are, you know, televised. We have one game a week that's televised on Fox College Sports, and then because we have our game of the week on Sunday on radio. But for the most part, you don't have those commercial breaks. You don't have to worry about it. So it's a problem at the major leagues, because that's what's paying the salaries of all these players. It isn't so much what the turnstiles. It's more the sponsors, the advertising sponsors, the baseball contracts. So with television and radio, both at the national level and at the team level as well. So that's the problem. Their bread is being buttered by these sponsors and by these advertisers. So I agree with Steve. It's going to have to be done so it's part already ingrained. And, you know, I think those are subtle changes that should speed the game up a little bit. I think that will help a lot. But I think also they're going to have to go to make the game stay popular. They're going to have to get more role models for these players. So I don't know if people have lost touch because of the high salaries. I'm not really sure. The game itself doesn't seem quite as popular. The other thing I would say was the lateness of these games. I remember they used to play the World Series games, and I'd rush home from grade school to come watch like the 1967 Red Sox play, and all the games were in the afternoon. They play them at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and that way the kids were able to see it. Now they can't stay up. These games don't start till 8:15, 8:30 at night. And the games are 3.5 hours long, sometimes 4 hours long. There's no way that the kids are staying up till past 1 o'clock on a school night, I don't think.
And again, that's national advertising revenue that's probably driving all of that.
Well, in fairness, a lot of the kids probably who are up that late are playing video games anyway. And I can say
possible.
That as someone who's 25 years old.
Yeah, that's possible, yeah.
Well, John, you say that the sport is declining in popularity, but there's still a lot of butter on that bread when you think about what they're paying some of these guys. This year we saw some record-breaking contracts going to free agents, Manny Machado, Bryce Harper.
It almost seems like it hasn't affected the high end, but look at it, even like some of the other players. We've got 10, 12 all-stars that still are out there that have not been signed yet. So something is happening. I don't think it's collusion, but I think, you know, some of these other players, some of the pitchers in particular that want these long contracts aren't getting them now. So something has changed. There's been a little change in the wind here. And, you know, the top players are still getting it. I don't know how Machado got that great contract, because I don't think he's been as successful maybe as some of the other players, but he certainly did.
Well, even people who don't follow baseball are likely to have seen those headlines in the last month or so. Manny Machado signing a $300 million contract, Bryce Harper a $330 million contract, and then Mike Trout over $400 million when you put it all together, that contract. It's a boggling amount of money for people to play baseball, it seems.
It is.
And that's what diminishing television ratings, diminishing... I mean, the Red Sox opener last year was 20% lower than it was last year. Now, part of the reason was they were playing, you know, on the West Coast. They were playing at 7 o'clock. They were playing the same night as the start of the NCAA Sweet 16. So I think there were some factors thrown in there. But that's a big, big downturn in my mind. That's for a defending World Series champion. So that was very interesting. That was the game that was on ESPN. So their numbers were way down. I don't know if you guys read that.
Yeah. I think that the when people from the outside who don't follow baseball see that kind of money, they just kind of shake their head, and it's not even an inducement to start watching baseball. You feel like something's going on there that's not so appealing in some ways.
Well, they do, but they also have to remember that money, of course, is paid out over the course of years, and with taxes and what you pay to the agents, you know, it still is a lot of money, and certainly you don't... You envy these people in a sense. But again, we were talking before the show, when you have to look at the ownership of these baseball franchises, and really any franchises across the major four sports in America, you have billionaire owners who, in a lot of times, will build a new stadium because that just enhances the value of their franchise. And a lot of times those stadiums are on the public, are paid by the public taxpayers. I mean, you had Miami Stadium, I think, was 70%. I think funded by taxpayers, and these, you know, these owners, that's their property that enhances the value of their franchise. And in some ways, they do have the money, they do have the power to sign these guys to big contracts, because at the end of the day, there's no salary cap in Major League Baseball. You can pay these guys however much they want. I mean, of course, there's a collective bargaining agreement for a reason, but when you look at these teams being overpaid, it's the value is just going up and up and up, and therefore player salaries are also going to go up and up, and that's the way it should be, right? That seems like the most fair to me.
John, it seemed to me a little bit like the sticking point with some of these free agents who weren't getting signed was the length of contract they were looking for.
Yes, and dealing with the pitchers.
Yeah,
they just don't see them being, you know, staying that long. You've got a 30-something old pitcher that wants a 6-year contract at this exorbitant thing. It doesn't make fiscal sense to do it. Everyday player is a little bit different, particularly if he's in his mid to late 20s. You're going to get a lot of the prime years. You can't really pay for what a person's done. You have to look toward the future and pay that person for what they think they're worth going forward. And that seems to make a lot more fiscal sense. I like the salary cap in football. I think it's one of the things that's really made the NFL so popular, and certainly in these parts. I never thought I would live to see the day where the Red Sox were replaced as the number one team, but they certainly have been. Even coming off, you know, they're a solid number two, but I think the Patriots in the last 15 years have become the most popular team in the area. Even all you have to do is listen to the talk show, and even on opening day, they're all talking about the Patriots, you know, not about the opening of the season, which is interesting to me. That never would have happened 10 to 15 years ago.
Well, in some ways, it sometimes seems that football is almost designed to be talked about on radio and picked apart in a way that baseball, it doesn't have some of the built-in drama and builds to like one game each week, which football does.
Yes.
And the personnel moves and the sort of coaching moves. But baseball is sort of this ongoing flow. It's 162 games, starts up, and you can count on it almost every night of the week. You turn it on, and there it is. You have a different relationship with it, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is a cliche that it's a marathon, not a sprint in Major League Baseball. So certainly it gives the fans more opportunity to go see that team, which is still nice. I'm actually a big fan of day baseball. I thought opening day, albeit the Red Sox were on the West Coast, I actually do kind of like watching baseball during the day because a lot of people might not go anyway. We were talking before the show. I mean, how much it is for beer now at Fenway Park, probably
yeah.
$12 or $14 a piece. It's expensive to go to a ball game. So the more opportunities, you know, you get to watch at different times during the day versus night, you know, it mixes things up a little bit and just gives fans different opportunities.
So I got a big...
I agree, Steve, and I think the getaway games are great, having them in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the third or fourth game of a long series, and you play that getaway game at 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then weekends. Here's a great opportunity for these teams to play in the afternoon. I know the Red Sox, a lot of times, particularly on Sunday afternoon, will play, but they've gotten the habit in the last maybe 15, 20 years of playing a lot of night games mm-hmm. on Saturday night. I just don't think that's a good thing. I think playing your weekend games, you know, at 1 o'clock at home during the West Coast, you can play at 4. I think that makes all the difference in the world. And I think that's going to recapture those younger fans that they're losing. There's no question they're losing some of the younger fans. And if they went to more day baseball, I think they might recapture that.
I have a big question for you guys. We're talking here about the declining popularity of the sport and some of the things that need to be sort of addressed. But what is it about baseball that you just love and that keeps you coming back? Like, I I swear, all through January and February, my family will tell you I'm kind of like saying, all right, the truck is going to leave to bring the equipment down to the Florida training camp in middle of February. And like, I follow the beginning of the season because it means so much. And now it's started where, you know, it'll be a home opener a week from today. And I just love it. I love the season. But tell me, what is it that keeps you coming back?
Well, in some ways, it almost feels like we are in spring training, just given how abysmal the start of the Red Sox season has been.
Anyone who hasn't followed, the Red Sox are starting very poorly this year.
And now you're seeing the conspiracy theories that, you know, that they're tanking early in the year so their pitchers are better later in the year. Or the one that actually makes more sense to me is that with the Red Sox, they always seem to have to be chasing something, right? There always has to be the naysayers and the doubters, and they have to prove them wrong. I mean, you saw that all last year with a pitcher like David Price, who was picked apart in the media for his attitude. He had a bad playoff record, and he finally put it all together and won the World Series. So maybe it's that carrot and the stick thing, giving them that challenge and not making it like last year where, again, they were wire-to-wire the winners. But for me, you asked, you know, what keeps me coming back. You know, it's the line from Field of Dreams. I mean, baseball marks the time. It's just the tradition when you know that spring is right around the corner, when, like you said, the truck heads down to Florida each year. And then when the first game is played at Fenway Park, it's like, you know, it's like winter's over. You know, yeah. The sun's come out, let's all celebrate. Let's go to the ballpark. You know, I try to get there at least once a year to see a game. Getting a little bit better with that now that I moved back to the area. But it's just, it's a tradition. You remember going to I personally remember going to the games with my father, and, you know, I was 8 or 10 years old, getting an ice cream, getting it all over my face and learning what Sweet Caroline is, you know, all those different traditions that you just, you fondly remember growing up with.
John, what about you?
Well, I grew up in a baseball family. My, both my dad and his father-in-law both played semi-professional baseball, and, my grandfather was the catcher, my father was a pitcher, and my dad's actually in the Maine Baseball Hall of Fame and UMass Lowell Baseball Hall of Fame, or Sports Hall of Fame. So I grew up in a family that loved baseball. Without baseball, none of us five kids probably would have been born. So I have a real, real good feeling about baseball, because I don't think my parents would have ever, you know, gotten together and met if it hadn't been for baseball. And it's something that you can bring up through your whole youth. I've, you know, played it as a youngster and followed it throughout my whole life. And luckily, being a youngster and going through, I never had to go through the lean years with the Red Sox, because since 1967, they've really been nothing but a competitive winning baseball team. They might have had a blip on the screen like the Bobby Valentine year, but as Steve mentioned, the very next year, they win the World Series when John Farrell. So you never saw that before, because they had a, from 1946 to 67, they were mostly in last place or next to last place, and crowds were dismal. And ever since 1967, it's been magical here in New England, and that's what has really perked me up to baseball at the national level.
You know, I think that it's such a human game that with 162 games and you tune in, I love to listen to baseball, and you hear them just filling the time, as you say, Steve, but you're following these personalities, following Jackie Bradley Jr., this outfielder who's got so much potential and hits these long slumps. And for, you know, it seems like for a whole month he can't get a hit. He couldn't buy a hit. And then suddenly he breaks out and you feel connected to these people. And when they triumph, it feels like, oh, my good friend just had a great moment. And when they're struggling, you feel like you're in it with them a little bit, too. So
right. And when you see them play in the Cape League, when you say, hey, I remember watching that guy, you're right. It does feel like kind of that blue-collar thing. It's like, I remember when this is just a college man. Now he's a professional athlete. It's just, it's great stuff. And certainly, you know, what I say before, 70 days away from the Cape League season, it's right around the corner.
John, when does the Cape League open? Tell us.
Yeah, it actually starts on the 10th of June, and the players will all be flocking in that week. We've actually got a bunch of things going on during the offseason. I don't know if you guys have heard, I'm sure Steve has heard, that they've raised about $1.6 million for Scarifile Field in Hyannis, and that's a park that's always taken on a lot of water. They've smoothed out the whole surface of the field. They've raised up the entire playing surface by about 3 or 4 feet, and that'll help things a great deal. Putting in new dugouts,
Very good.
Electronic scoreboard.
John, we got to let it go there because we've run out of time talking about baseball today. I want to thank my guest, Steve Derderian from the Cape Cod Times. Thanks, Steve, for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And real quickly, happy birthday, Mom. Appreciate you listening.
And John Garner from the Cape Cod Baseball League. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.